We are going to center ourselves in Exodus 34. And so if you have a Bible, great, you can pull that out. If you need a Bible, we have some available. We can get that to you if you would like. We're going to do our best to throw the text up on the screen so you can follow along that way as well. So have you ever read anything in the Bible where you came across it and thought to yourself, what? Like, what is that? And if that means what I think it means, at least when I see it, then that's a problem. That's concerning. That's frightening. That's frustrating. That's irritating. Or if it's true, then whoa. Or if it's true in how I think it. So when we approach this series, Who is God? The reality is we come to that question a lot of times with all sorts of things swirling in our heads. We may have no idea, and we may have a bunch of images and pictures and ideas and thoughts, and we bring that to the table. But one thing we need to know when we come to the Bible, one scholar, Kenneth Bailey, he's been in Israel, has lived in Israel, studied, he's a brilliant scholar. He's been there for about 30 years, doing a lot of archaeological work and a lot of study. And he talks about, just in the simplest of ways, he says this: we have to know this, being in our setting, that the Bible, first and foremost, is an Eastern book. It comes from the East. We see it, we here, see it through colored glasses of Western culture. Much is lost. We miss the subtleties of humor and many of the underlying assumptions. What lies between the lines, what is felt and not spoken, is of deepest significance. The reality, we come at it from a perspective, and yet the Bible itself comes from a very Eastern way of thinking. And in the Eastern world, they think in terms of pictures, metaphors, images, first and foremost. So a lot of the times what we see in the Bible, and if we go, wow, that's what it is, and it's going, well, actually, we're just doing our best to paint a picture for you, to give you an idea of what's going on. And then when we come to our text that we've been looking at over the last number of weeks, Exodus 34, we read in the beginning of it can sound like, oh, that's good. And then we'll hit a snag as we kind of get toward the end, and we're like, what does that mean? So let's look at this text, Exodus 34, verses 4 to 7. And it says this: so Moses, and so what we have, the setting anyways, is this gentleman named Moses is leading the Israelite people, these Hebrew people. They've been led out of Egypt. They've been in slavery for over 400 years, and he leads them out at God's command. God's guiding them out. And now God said, I'd like to connect with you and show you, teach you how to have life. Because if you're in slavery, you don't know what it means to actually live. So I'd like to walk you through having life and having life with me. And so God meets with Moses and says, here's what I want you to do. So Moses is instructed to chisel out two stone tablets, like the first ones he broke, and went up to Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord, and this is fascinating, then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him, God, with Moses, and proclaimed his name, the Lord. Now, this is important when he proclaims his name, the Lord. In the ancient world, and again, in the East, a name meant more than just, hey, this is my name, so you know, give the coffee to Bob. No. A name is a one-word biography. It's the essence of a person. It's who they are. It's their identity or who they're called to be. So then we move on, and it says, and he passed in front of Moses proclaiming. Now he's going to tell you, this is who I am, Moses, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God. Oh, I like that. Slow to anger. Circle that. Abounding in love, nice. And faithfulness, yes. Maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Well, I like that. Yet, he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. Whoa. What? So in this, God is both slow to anger, yet punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. Somehow God is both supremely patient, and yet there is punishment that seems to be, well, that's a bit over the top, isn't it? Seems a bit much. Something seems wobbly here. So the question we would raise, or I would raise, is do we have a contextual issue? Do we have something else going on here? Now, one of the things that kind of strikes me as funny is I have three sons. And so for my in-laws, my mother and father-in-law, this is their, right now at this point, this is their first and only grandkids. And so my three boys, boy, in grandma and grandpa's eyes, you know, can they do any wrong? No, no, no. But what's hilarious, my mother-in-law specifically will be playing with, the boys will be playing with their grandpa and playing with grandpa. And if something goes wrong, the boys do something, something happens at all, the boys do something, she immediately go, oh, well, you made them do that. It's grandpa's fault. It's always like the boys will do something and we're like, hey, come here, sir, you can't talk that way. And she'll immediately go, yeah, well, he kind of baited him into it. Grandpa did it. Grandpa, and it's like, what? Because the boys can't do anything. So it's grandpa's. So is that what's going on here? The only way the boys make mistakes is it's because grandpa. He's the problem. Is that what the text is saying? Or is there something else? We looked at A.W. Tozer, a 20th century writer. He says this that's really important. A.W. Tozer says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes to mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. So right away we ask the question, is God good or is God bad? Is God good or is God bad? Is God distant and angry and just itching to zip lightning bolts at us when we mess up? And children and their children, oh, I can't wait to punish them. We got to get them. Are we just a bunch of sinners in the hands of an angry God, as it said? So the text in which this is, we've been in, speaks about a God who offers love and forgiveness, compassion, in a giant embrace. So the Israelite people must be learning something new here and what it means to grow in relationship to this God. So the thing is, what they've been learning, what we're going to look into, it's an ongoing learning because we're still learning it today. And we have a really, really hard time with learning this. Now, we'll back it up to get some context. God has led these people out of slavery. And we have an Exodus 20. We're in Exodus 34. We're going to back it up to Exodus 20. And it's where God is giving them what we'd call the Ten Commandments, the 10 words, instructions on how to live. And within that, within those instructions, Exodus 20, verse 5 and 6, we have a piece of our text. And it reads like this. You, God is talking to them about not having idols, not carving images and worshiping pictures of this God, having something to try and get their hands around. It says, you shouldn't bow down to them, these idols, or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing, there it is, the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Sane is the Hebrew word hate, and it just means to make an enemy of God, to not love. And then it says, so punishing them, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So we back it up and we go, oh, it's got pieces of our text in it, but what's the difference? Well, the difference is when we look at our text then, it goes a little something like this. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin, and it stops. In Exodus 34, what has already changed is where is, and giving love, but it's love to those who love me and keep my commandments. That's no longer there. And what? The Jewish study Bible, Jewish people point out this section is left out because what they're already coming to learn about this God is his love. This love is unconditional. That love by this God is unconditional. Love and forgiveness is extended to those not only those who return love and follow all the commands. Love is for everybody. Love is for all. Forgiveness is for all. It's invited here. You have it. Everyone is invited to this. Their love is not based on what you do or don't do. Love is offered to all. This is already what they're learning. And the way we would say it, and it's important, or at least the way I would say it, is God is not Santa Claus walking around with his list of who's naughty and nice, and we'll see who gets my love and who gets my forgiveness. We'll figure it, not you. You, not you. That's Santa Claus. That's not God. We can tend to mess that up. In other words, the way I would say it is God is not a bookkeeper. How many people think of God as a bookkeeper? He's up there and he's like, good, 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 bad, good, bad, mark down. Okay, you're in the plus 4 points. You're in the negative. I wouldn't bet on them, Vegas. Ridiculous. God is not a bookkeeper. So I love this. One of my favorite writers, just so eloquent, is Robert Farrar Capone, and he says this about this idea of bookkeeping. He says, we don't want to get to that one. Opening up the book of life, God will read your name, nothing else. None of your bad deeds because he erased them all, and none of your good deeds because he didn't count them, he just enjoyed them. Are you with me? He's not up there keeping track of good, bad. No. Bad, erased. Remember, forgiveness. He doesn't remember them. Your good deeds, I don't write them down in a book when I'm playing with my kids. You did, I had such a blast with you today. I'm putting that in the good book that you did well today and we laughed together. But I also have a book that I'm going to read to you next week at the end of the week that has all your garbage in it so I can shame you in too. Sometimes that's a, what? Now we have a book of some of our quotes, like quotes of our kids because they're crazy, but we don't keep record, not a bookkeeping idea. God is not a bookkeeper. Love is extended to all. Forgiveness is extended to all people. In other words, everyone is invited to the party. The question is, will you accept the invitation to the party? Will you accept the invitation to the party? Now, what I want to do is I want to read a quote by Robert Farrar Capone. I want to read it, then I want to put it up on screen because this one, I think, sometimes is jarring for us. The old baloney about heaven being for good guys and hell being for bad guys is dead wrong. Heaven is populated entirely by forgiven sinners, not spiritual and moral aces. It's not for the perfect. And here's the thing, hell is populated entirely by forgiven sinners. The only difference between the two groups is that those in heaven accept the forgiveness and those in hell reject it, which is why heaven is a party. Are you with me? My son is. There it is. So the old baloney about heaven being for good guys and hell being for bad guys is dead wrong. Heaven is populated entirely by forgiven sinners. So is hell. If the difference is who accepts it and who rejects it. Which is why heaven is a party, which leads to God being slow to anger, and yet the guilty don't go unpunished. So now we dig in. Slow to anger then. The Hebrew word for slow to anger, the Hebrew scriptures, what we often call the Old Testament, is written in Hebrew. It's recorded in Hebrew, so we dig in. Slow to anger is erech aipaim. Erech aipaim is how it would be, which means, get this, long of nostrils. That's what the slow to anger actually means, long of nostrils. Because the Eastern world, again, thinks in terms of pictures and images. So they're creating a picture of God who has long nostrils. Why? Here's why. When you express your anger, when you're ticked off, it's, we take a deep breath and I get on leash on you now. Blah, 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 blah. So I need to take a deep breath. And what it's saying is God has long nostrils in which he can deep breath and hold it in and keep breathing so that he can purse his lips and not just light into us. So they're painting a picture that God is long of nostrils. He can breathe in and keep his mouth shut. Now, the Aramaic, there's an Aramaic translation from the Hebrew into the Greek for the New Testament. So in other words, in the first century, this is one of the ways in which they would read this passage. This is an understanding of it. It says, God is patient. The one who makes anger distant and brings compassion near, is how it would read. The one who makes anger distant and compassion near. Yahweh is the name. His anger is far away, but his compassion is close by. So in other words, here's how we would say it. You can make God mad, but you really, really have to work at it. Because anger is there. Now, what is it? Slow to anger. There is anger, but what God reserves his anger for is that which matters most. God expresses his anger when it's a righteous anger. So when God expresses his anger, it's jarring. Whoa, where did that come from? And it awakens us to the seriousness of the moment. What is going on here that God gets upset? So in other words, it's not a selfish anger, which is more typical of our anger. I've been wrong, and you can't say that, and we snap and we lose it. God's anger is reserved for the most serious of things. Righteousness. God's anger is about injustice and oppression. You want to see in the scriptures where God gets mad? When there is injustice and oppression, kind of like Abraham Lincoln, which is exactly what you were thinking, I know. So the idea is, anybody see the movie Lincoln, where Daniel Day-Lewis, no one? Okay, there we go, good. Yep. So Lincoln, this movie came out a few years ago, Lincoln on the idea of Abraham Lincoln, and Daniel Day-Lewis, one of the best actors there is, he plays Abraham Lincoln, and there's this stunning scene in the movie where he sits down with his cabinet, he calls his cabinet, and what Abraham Lincoln's trying to get passed is the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. We need to get rid of slavery. And he sits down with his cabinet, it gets late at night, and the cabinet is arguing and bickering, and all of them, 100% of them, are against Lincoln. We don't want this passed. And so they're fighting and arguing, and he is just sitting there. And you see this scene, and Lincoln is just sitting there. And they're bickering and arguing back and forth. Finally, he snaps. Boom! His hand goes down on the table. He slams it, and he stands up. And everybody, whew, silence. And then he launches into this monologue. This is not right. And everybody's quiet, and everybody listens, and guess what? Everybody gets on board. Why? Because it's startling that he would get angry. It's so seemingly out of character for Lincoln to snap and get upset. When what that does is, whoa, this is a big deal. This matters. We better pay attention. Very similar to slow to anger, and so when God gets upset, we better pay attention. And the way we would understand it is in Jesus, in the New Testament, Jesus is the best picture of God that we have. God incarnate, if you will, in the flesh. This is what God is like. This is how God is. The question is, did Jesus ever get upset? Anybody know, did Jesus get upset? Can someone give me an example of Jesus getting upset? Temple money changers, excellent. There is this scene anyways where Jesus goes into the temple and goes all Indiana Jones, makes a whip, and he runs the animals out and the money changers. Doesn't say he's whipping people, but he's creating a scene, he's flipping tables over and he's driving people out saying, what you're doing in this temple, in the house of worship is not okay. Now here's the thing. Jesus, as we understand, is about 30 years old. Is this his first time at the temple? No, it's not. In fact, he's probably been there many, many, many. Every single year he goes to the temple with his family. It's how many times at the temple has this been going on? So it's not like he shows up and goes, what's going on here? Oh, I gotta... Year after year, time after time in the temple, are you guys going in this direction? Are you gonna use the temple for this kind of thing? It's a build. And Jesus is like, you know what? I've had enough. We will not treat my Father's house this way. This is not okay. Now, the thing is, if I say to you, great, give me 5 or 6 more examples, because I said, give me an example of Jesus getting angry, and right away, at the temple. 5 or 6 other examples where Jesus just goes, oh, because we don't have a whole lot of them. Because Jesus reserves his anger for that which matters most. We got to get after this. And here's the thing, though. It's mentioned in all what we say biographies of Jesus, the Gospels. This story is in all four of them, which is rare, which is a neon light saying, pay attention, this is a big deal. And yet at the same time, we don't have all kinds of records of Jesus getting ticked off. And by the way, flipping over the money changers, where this would have taken place is in the Gentile court, most likely, as they would understand it. In other words, this is the section where the outsiders can come, but you can't go any further into the temple. So in other words, it's as Jesus is saying, people are trying to worship my Father, and you're creating a barrier, and that is not okay. You're in the way of people trying to connect with my Father, and I'm not okay with that. So what's he get upset with? Someone putting up a barrier to God. Well, that's going to get him upset. This story is about Jesus reserving his anger for that which matters most, seen in the oppression of the marginalized. So then we have the wisdom literature, what we call wisdom literature, that invites us to model this character of God about being slow to anger. So in Proverbs 14:29, is where we start. 14:29 first, it says, whoever is patient, that's Erech Apayim, whoever is Erech Apayim, long of nostrils, patient, has great understanding. But one who is quick-tempered displays folly. Then in Proverbs 16:32, it says, whoever is slow to anger, Erech Apayim, is better than the mighty. And he who rules his spirit, this is self-control, better than one who takes a city. The puff of the chest and get angry and take things out or whatever and this whim. Well, the one who's slow to anger, that's actually better. If you're slow to anger, it's not that you don't have feelings of anger. It's just you're not enslaved to them. They don't rule the roost, if you will. Which is the brilliance of the law found in Exodus and Leviticus. And I would say this, one of the most relevant, if not most relevant with Revelation, I would say, book for us today is Leviticus, which is exactly what you thought. And since you all have Leviticus memorized, you're like, exactly. But you're thinking, Leviticus, don't they have the wonky, that thing is like weird. And they do this and cut that and kill this thing. And what are we doing here? But what it is what the law is doing is helping people grow up. So you think of something like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. What was happening in that day, in that time, is someone steals my donkey, I'll burn your whole farm down. You come and punch my servant, I'll kill your whole family. So the law comes in to says, wait a minute, hold on, that's not okay. It should be an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. In other words, the punishment should fit the crime. You steal someone's donkey, you owe them a donkey. It's a step forward. It's actually helping people decrease violence and actually not work in vengeance, in revenge, but let's actually have some semblance of structure here. Then you have in Matthew, in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus comes along, and here's what he says. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say, don't resist the enemy. What? What Jesus is saying, because at that point, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, they've made the law the goal. Oh, guess what? We're using the law now. Oh, you stole? I'm going to steal from you. And that's how they're doing it. Oh, you can get them. And Jesus is like, see your posture already. You're using the law to justify violence. That wasn't the point. The point was to help you grow up. Keep growing up. You stopped. Don't stop growing up. So you have heard it said, an eye for an eye, but what I'm telling you is don't resist your enemy. In other words, you need to be moving more and more toward love. Do you see the brilliance of the law? It was an invitation to grow up. And we still are growing up and need that. The law isn't the point. The invitation to grow up is the point. Erech Apayim, this long of nostrils, is also translated long-suffering. Long-suffering, which is incredibly helpful because God, in other words, absorbs a lot of our immaturity and selfishness, but doesn't allow us to stay in it. He doesn't enable us. He puts up with a lot. Why? Because He's more interested in your long-term character than your short-term happiness. If God were quick-triggered, we wouldn't be here, none of us. Because unless you're perfect, I don't think anyone is, we'd be in deep trouble. But God is long of nostrils. He is long suffering, puts up a lot, because he, as a good parental picture, is helping people grow up. And I don't know about you, but I'm incredibly grateful for that. So it's an invitation in ways. How can we grow in our patience, our long suffering? How can we get longer nostrils? You can leave and say, what did you learn at church this morning and when you gathered? I had to have longer nostrils. Okay. Tell me about that, please. But in other words, is our anger reserved for that which matters most? Do we save our energy and our anger for injustice, oppression? I talk about this with my wife all the time. It exhausts me when I give my energy to stuff that doesn't seem to matter, the little piddly things. And then when we come up against something that matters and you don't have the energy or the resources because you spent it all on piddly stuff, ugh. What I feel is, man, I got to stop doing that. And I got to get better at so that when it matters, we're ready to roll. Does anybody feel that in our world today? So now we need to step into the punishing text. So there's this general idea of punishment for sin, and then there's this whole punishing to the third and fourth generation, which seems a bit kind of excessive. So first and foremost, the way people, they would understand God's wrath, first and foremost, the way we understand this idea of wrath is there are not natural consequences for sin. There are natural consequences, and we're going to riff here. One of the consequences to porn is that it damages our relationships. One of the consequences to lying is that you can no longer be trusted after a while. You might make money by cheating, lying, dabbling a little over here, and so you make money, and so you win in shallow ways, but what happens is in the long run, you damage that which matters most, which is relationships and people. And at some point, there are consequences. That is a problem. So first, wrath is not found in lightning bolts, but in the consequences of sin. Sin breaks God's heart, much the way we teach our kids, do we not? This, we see our kids do things and we can see it coming. Did anybody ever see it coming? Oh, he's gonna pop his head. He's gonna trip and fall. He's gonna da-da-da-da-da. She's gonna, uh-oh. And we see it coming, and as a parent, grandparent, aunt and uncle in love, we see somebody, a friend, and we're like, ah, I want to save them from that pain, right? And yet at the same point, there is something within relationship where you go, you know what? The only way they're going to get it is if they feel the sting a little bit, right? And I don't know about you, for my kids, sometimes they're doing something, I'm going to, oh, he's going to smack his finger and it's going to sting. I like chop it off, but he's going to bump it and he's going to feel that pain. And I go, boy, I hate that for him. But here's the thing. If he doesn't do that, then maybe someday he's going to be a third world dictator. So he needs to feel that sting. See how my mind jumps? Ah, you pinch your finger one more time then. Until you grow and like go, man, that hurts. I better stop doing that. Ah, maybe you should. As a parent, you sit down with them then and go, yeah, that was a bad idea, wasn't it? Wasn't it? So this is kind of the picture of God. God's love, in other words, creates space for the freedom of choice. We have a say. We have options, which might have us eating cake and celebrating another wedding anniversary. Or it might have us sitting at home one more year, all alone, watching The Walking Dead because our actions have ruined the relationship. We have choices. We have options. God gives us this. Consequences are about waking us up to change. How much space do you leave for consequences before the heart is just plain dark and twisted, though? That's the balance. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. Ready for some good, helpful language. We take the Hebrew and we translate it, and it helps a lot. So this word unpunished is the word nakaw. Go ahead and say nakaw. You're all great birds this morning. Nakaw, right? So nakaw, and here's the thing though. It means to make clean. This is what the word unpunished means, to make clean. In other words, God doesn't leave the guilty filthy. God doesn't, he's not the lunatic flying off the handle and chucking lightning bolts. No, 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 no. What he is doing is he wants to make clean. That's the goal. restoration, to clean up. So God doesn't just leave a mess. His goal then is to clean up. That's where this is heading. So God is slow to anger, but then God acts in order to clean up the mess. God acts in relationship to cleanse and restore us. Jesus says, at the renewal of all things, this is where it's heading. Peter in the book of Acts says, at the restoration of all things. The writer Paul calls this the reconciliation of all things. This is the trajectory. Things are getting cleaned up, and this is where it's heading. So the question is, will you get on board with that? There is a theme, and it's to put back together, to clean up. I love it. So then what does punish look like? So the word punish in the Hebrew is the word pakad. Go ahead and say pakad. Pakad. Now here's the beauty of it. It means to visit. To visit. Now, if you read some of the literal translations, the NASB, ESV, it actually says to visit. The Jewish study Bible, Jewish people coming from the Hebrew, they have to visit. God visits the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. Does that not help? Because a lot of times in our mind, we hear punish and we think, oh, here we go, divine spanking. To visit. In other words, how crucial is context and language here? To leave unpunished was to be to not clean up the mess, to not invite the recognition there is a mess. God's justice can't allow for that. And to visit is a picture of relationship. You want the picture? God comes, says, hey, kids, sit down. Come here. I'll pull you close. God meets with him. Let's have a talk. And it says, let's talk about the sin of the third and fourth generation. Here's what I want to do is I want to sit down with you and talk about your grandpa and your great-grandpa, your grandma and your great-grandma. And let's talk about the life that they lived or are living. And that's part of the beauty of it is the third and fourth generation would go as far as about what you could live to see. And so let's sit down and talk about it. They did some things really, really well. That's great. You know what? Your grandpa, he did some things really, really wrong too. Can we talk about that? Because here's the thing. That can bleed into you. You can feel that and you can see it. So God's sitting down and say, maybe we ought to right that wrong. Maybe we ought to clean up the mess. You can do that. Your grandpa, boy, he had an anger problem and he used to fly off the handle. And you maybe saw that a bit in your dad, your mom. And here's the thing, maybe you feel something stirring inside you. You can put an end to that. So God visits the kids and said, let's talk about changing that, doing that better. Do we have a better picture of this text now? This section of the passage is about a parent sitting down and talking with their kids. You can live beyond this. Stunning. And then we see the prophet Ezekiel telling the Israelite people, this is where it's heading. This is what it looks like. So we have in Ezekiel 18, 19, and 20, it says this. Yet you say, why does the son not bear the iniquity of the father with him? When the son has done what is lawful and right, has kept all my statutes, all my rules and such, and has done them, he will surely live. Not just live as in breathing, but experience life. The soul that sins, well, he will die. Not just die as in no longer breathing, but a death of the soul a bit. So no, that's not what's going on here. The son will not bear the iniquity of the father with him, nor will the father bear the iniquity of the son with him. The righteousness of the righteous will be on him, and the wickedness of the wicked will be on him. If the son puts an end to the habits of those before him, that's life-giving to the soul. Sons, you have an opportunity to change this, is what Ezekiel's saying. Hey, all the problems, and by the way, Israel was in exile in Babylon. They messed up big time. And so it's the prophet saying, God is going to sit down with you and say, do you look what happened to your ancestors? And do you see where we are today? Don't repeat that. So as a great parent, he sits down with his kids and says, let's change what has been going on. While maintaining love to thousands or to the thousandth generation. Here's the thing. This is an ancient Hebrew way. So it's like, we're going to sit down with the kids and talk about these short things, generations, but just know that my love, God says, goes to the thousandth generation or to thousands. It's a way, it's a Hebrew way of saying forever. It's the way we would say a quadrillion. It's like a quadrillion generations. That's what the Hebrew understanding would be is, yeah, this love, it goes on forever. But this idea of sitting down, let's talk about these most recent things and fix them. So, God is long of nostrils. This God is supremely patient. And yet this God desires for you and I to grow up and become more. God is good, and good was in the beginning. God is good, good is in the ending, and this is the trajectory. This is the meta movement of the biblical narrative. It's restorative, it's not punitive. It's putting things back together, not destroying. So God actually wants to pull up a chair at the campfire, visit with his kids, and talk about life. How's it going? What needs to be cleaned up? What needs to stop with you? This is the picture of God. It's not the accountability partner waiting for you to screw up. Anybody ever have that? Oh, I got to meet with Dave today, and he's going to ask me the question, did you screw up this week? Do I want to have breakfast with that? No. But when it's, hey, sit down and just say, hey, remember we set these things? That our trajectory is growing? Are we walking in that? Are we doing that together? We're talking about the ways in which you can be empowered and grow, which includes, that's not helpful. So we don't want to do that. But when I know you're for me and for us winning, growing, becoming more, that's totally different than the person who's like, if you messed up, I'm ready to bring the zinger. No thanks. Best way forward. God is relationship. So God visits with us to be with us. I need that. How about you? It's an invitation to learn from those who have gone before us and to participate in putting all things back together. So are there any ways in which we need to be moving things forward? And are there anything we need to be shutting down, turning off, breaking up? That can no longer go forward. It's not helpful for me or for others. It needs to be redeemed and then removed. This is the invitation. This is a good parent who's sitting down and coaching us, teaching us, guiding us to becoming more. In fact, becoming what we were designed to be. That's what this text is all about. And that's beautiful. Would you pray with me? Father God, you are good. You are good, you are good, you are good. God, I am grateful that you desire to be with us, that you pull us near, you invite us to pull up a seat with you because you desire for us to continue to grow and become more and more who you create us to be. You are more than willing to sit down and celebrate the wins. Yes, this is us participating with you, putting all things back together. And you, God, are incredibly patient with us. And I need that. And I'm so grateful that you are, that you're patient with us. And yet, when things go off the rails, when things keep descending into destruction, you will step in and sit down and say, this can't happen anymore. Too much destruction. Not okay. That's not how you operate. So you want to sit down with us and highlight these things need to stop. And you invite us to grow and grow up and remove that. You give us the strength, the power to remove that but you can't go forward. Not in your good world. So God, I'm grateful that you are an amazing parent. You are a good father. Pictures of what that looks like. You love us. You're an incredible creator, sustainer. And you love us and you're guiding us to a new way to be human, a new way to live. Even today, we bless you, God. I pray for anyone in here struggling, wrestling, but also naming in their head right now, they know those things have to stop. God, I pray your strength, your power, your love would embrace them now. Surround them with people, a community who will guide them to the next right step. People who will be your body, and you will give strength to name and to stop that which can't go forward in you. You're a good God. We love you. We pray all of this and we sing in celebration, response, reflection, all of this in the name of Christ Jesus. Amen.